Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Over the holiday season, a family member of mine was gifted a copy of the Vermont Almanac. I spent some time by the fire flipping through it, and the experience felt akin to what it feels like to me to take a long, meandering drive through our state. But instead of zooming through a town or just passing by a farmhouse, you stop and you go in and say hello. On page 43, for example, there's a how-to on carving a wooden spoon. Page 23 has a photo of a man named Carl in blaze orange and camo holding a moose heart. On page 165, there's a haiku by Spence Putnam of Weybridge. It reads, "Small town gatherings help build strong communities, potlucks and picnics." The Vermont Almanac is an annual publication that released its fifth volume at the end of last month. Each year, its editors include prose, poetry, photography, and illustrations from dozens of local contributors. We're joined in the studio today by two Vermont Almanac editors. Patrick White, who also runs Meadow Ridge Farm, a Christmas tree farm, joins us from Middlesex. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you, Michaela. Appreciate it.
And Dave Mance III, a sugar maker in Shaftesbury and former editor of Northern Woodlands magazine. Welcome, Dave.
It's great to be here, Michaela.
And I should also note that the Vermont Almanac is a Vermont Public Business sponsor. And listeners, you can join our conversation today. Are you a Vermont Almanac contributor? What was your essay or your poem or contribution about? You can call in at 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. First, if you'll allow me, before we dive into the almanac itself, I know you two both have very seasonal businesses going on right now. Patrick, you have a Christmas tree farm. How have the past couple weeks been?
The last week's been pretty nice. Before that was a little hectic, but a good kind of hectic.
Yeah.
Business was good. I hope the other Christmas tree farmers around the state had a good season as well.
Yeah. And Dave, you are a sugar maker. You have a sugar bush there with how many taps? Quite a lot.
Yeah, we do about 3,500, which, for somebody with it's a family operation and with other irons in the fire, it's big, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, there's operations with 50 and 75,000 taps in the state where that's all they do. But it's good. It's a nice break after working on this book all summer and fall to be able to take a break and get back into the woods and kind of live the woods life and the working life.
Yeah.
Kind of keeps me balanced.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the Vermont Almanac origin story. And Dave, I'll start with you. You two worked together at Northern Woodlands. Is that right? How did the Almanac grow out of that publication and your connections there?
We did. Well, I worked with Pat, who's just a great coworker, also with Virginia Barlow and Amy Peberty, who are also Woodlands alums who work on the Almanac with us, and we were really intrigued with the idea of shrinking the model. Woodlands was a quarterly magazine that covered the whole Northeast, and we liked the idea of we're all from Vermont, we all live here. We liked the idea of tunnel visioning and really being able to cover in depth and explore things that were close by.
Patrick, how did you get involved in this new venture? I mean, shrinking the model sounds great and all, but it also is it's a tough market out there for a small publication.
Yeah, I think it was probably audacious to contemplate putting a book out in the print media's it's not an easy environment ever probably, and particularly difficult now. And we decided to do it 2 months before the pandemic started. So there was an added challenge. I think our first couple of meetings, we met in person at Virginia Barlow's house, sat around her kitchen table, and sort of hatched the idea. But shortly thereafter, sort of everything shut down, and we one thing we're not is tech savvy, so we probably with a lot of other people had to figure out how to navigate Zoom and sort of electronic meetings. So a lot of the early planning was actually done that way, remotely. But I think we, as Dave said, we wanted to focus on a state that doesn't always get a lot of attention, and particularly the rural parts of the state. I loved your introduction, Michaela, where you sort of described it as reading the book as driving along a dirt road, but stopping in to talk to people. And I think that's probably what we didn't put so eloquently, but I think that's what we were trying to do. And it's glad on the year five that's still coming through. And I think we wanted to. There's a lot of neat things that happen on dirt roads in the state, and it's been fun to explore those. And I think that was sort of our original mission, and it's neat to see that we're still able to do that.
Yeah. So you did write quite eloquently of that mission in a preamble to this year's almanac. Dave, I'm wondering if you might be able to read the second half of that preamble for us, because it's so beautifully written.
Sure. How do we feed our heads? Through challenge, we'd suggest. Technology promises a frictionless existence. Seek out things that are real and hard instead. Social media works to stylize your life and share it with the world. Cultivate an inner life instead. In a world of abundance, choose scarcity. Loosen up on your judgments about the way things ought to work. Nurture a contrarian opinion or two. Have a mind like a fox, as Wendell Berry once wrote, and make more tracks than are necessary, some in the wrong direction. Gravitate towards things that are beautiful. Lean into things you cannot understand. Remember what it's like to read for pleasure and make the time to do it. Turn to page 36 immediately and read Melanie Finn's essay that opens the month of November. Periodically write your own obituary, ponder the word ancestor, and reflect on the idea that someday you'll be one. Take time away from screens, time away from screeds. Seek out physical work that leaves your body tired and sore. Consider the sore muscles your profit. Invest in everything that involves people you love. Internalize seasonal rhythms. Consider food that was grown in or on the earth wholly. Plan a food plot for insects. Cultivate quiet. Tell stories where the trees are protagonists. Look at the lines on your palm and see that, like wood, your skin has grain. Interrogate human failures, but believe in human potential. Celebrate your elders. Celebrate young people and new ideas. Lift them up where you can. We hope that this book is worthy of your mind.
It's beautiful. Thank you so much for reading that. You mentioned one essay that starts the month of November. For folks who have not picked up a copy of the Vermont Almanac, maybe Patrick, you could explain how it's organized by month and season.
Yeah, each volume has 12 chapters that follow a month, and it's a lot of it's seasonal. March covers sugaring, that sort of thing, but it is a way to break down the year, I think, in a way that makes the book approachable for people. They can sit down and read it all at once, and some people do that, and others choose to follow it month by month and sort of track the rhythms of nature, what's happening in wildlife that month, maybe what's happening on farms that time of year, that sort of thing. So November, that the essay that was mentioned there is it's a beautiful essay, again, by Melanie Finn. And it really captures a sort of poignant diagnosis and passing of someone by tying it to the month, sort of looking out the window at what's happening in November. And it's an incredibly beautiful essay and an example of some of the sort of professional writer, capital W writer, contributors that we have to the almanac. And then there's dozens and dozens of contributors who may not consider themselves to be writers at all, who have a skill to share or an experience to share. And it's a joy to work with them as well, to get their experiences and thoughts on paper and to see, them now describe themselves as a writer after being published. It's one of the benefits of working with, I think, almost 70 Vermonters in Volume 5 is the just the incredible array of different backgrounds and skills of contributors that we work with.
Mm. Well, if you are a contributor or you want to be one, perhaps, or have a question about how the Vermont Almanac is put together, you can call in at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So nearly 70 contributors. Dave, where do you find all these folks? How do you cultivate them?
It's one of the great things about Vermont is that it's such a small state that it's kind of easy to find people, and it's easy for them to find you. Many of these folks that, I mean, Pat and I have both been in publishing in Vermont, and specifically Nature Publishing, for 20 years now, probably. So we've had a lot of these contributors who have been friends and colleagues over the years. But it's also such a small state that word of the book can get around like it's doing today, and then people can track us down. And in the very beginning, you mentioned that publishing is hard these days. And of course it is, because the internet kind of killed the 20th century publishing model, and there is no model anymore. But to turn the negative into a positive, there's also no rules, and so we can make a book a year, and we can be attentive to each month in the year. To just kind of piggyback on what something Pat just said, it's neat where we can reach out to writers who have books in the New York Times Book Review and say, you want to be part of this cool project, write about Vermont, rural life, and they'll say sure. And we can also go to a farm to report on something innovative that this farm's doing and find out that the farmer also wants to write a story about how to make a wreath for us or something. And it's neat because we're kind of making the model up as we go along.
So you mentioned a farmer wanting to write about making a wreath. I'm wondering if that spurs any other memories of submissions that kind of caught you by surprise. Maybe somebody who you thought would write about one thing came in with an idea for something else, or somebody who you didn't think would contribute saying, hey, I have this idea. What do you think? Not to put you on the spot there or anything, sorry. Because when I was flipping through, there's just such a wide range of stories. Again, the bloody moose heart in a guy's hand, and photos of a beautiful mountainside and paintings that people did.
Yeah, the moose heart story does sort of spur, I don't know if it was a surprise. It was written by a woman who maybe that's somewhat surprising stereotypically to write about hunting. But she wrote the story. Her name's Jenny Goyne. She's a nurse by profession and a photographer. And she took some beautiful photos for her piece, including that's her partner holding the moose heart.
It's really big.
It's really big.
Yeah.
we had a little internal debate about, whether that was too much gore or not, but it was just something about the composition of the shot. I think that won us over. And I think it probably would have done a disservice to the readers to not see that as they were reading about this moose hunt. Because
I'm personally glad you had it in.
Thought
it was very cool.
Thank you. A vote of confidence there. I think that was one of the first submissions that we got for Volume 5. And it was, it was a no-brainer to use it because again, we spoke with Jenny after the fact, and I asked her, do you consider yourself a writer? And she said, no, but I do now. I've been published in Vermont Almanac. And so I think that story from start to finish was surprising in so many ways. And I think, the theme of that story was the community that was involved in this hunt, from the family and friends who came together to help on the hunt itself, and processing the meat afterwards, to the horse draftsman who helped haul the moose out of the woods, a chef who took the moose nose because it's a delicacy in Abenaki food. There was a lot of surprises in that piece, and I think a particularly nice piece.
Yeah. Dave, what comes up for you?
The idea that I a lot of what we're doing is kind of passing along rural skills, and yeah. when you say that, you're immediately thinking of traditional skills, and we've certainly done that. I remember in Volume 4 we had somebody talking about how to make a black ash pack basket, but you know, to your original question about surprises, there was one in this thing where a contributor just found us, Joe Ringenberg, and with the emerald ash borer killing all the ash trees. He had these really meaningful trees in his front yard, and his kid's tire swing is hanging from one of them, and he wanted to keep them alive and looked into getting injections to try to keep this tree alive till his kid moved out of the house, and it was too expensive. And so he, in typical Vermont fashion, decided to get his own pesticide applicator's license and went in and took the classes and kind of wrote this humorous piece about, going through the bureaucracy that, however many hours of classes that could pretty much be summed up by the statement on the outside of the binder, which is, follow the directions. And, kept this ash tree alive for a fraction of the cost that it would have cost him. So there's a 21st century skill that I would have never thought as an editor to think we should get somebody to write about this, and yet it's also got such a rich look of where we are, and kind of the innovation that comes out of our reality.
Oh, well, what's more Vermont than that? That's doing right. It yourself.
That's right.
Patrick, when you and I first spoke, you told me that there were a number of stories in this volume of the Vermont Almanac that touched on faith, which I found interesting because Vermont is typically known as one of the least religious states in the country. What are some of the ways that faith, if not religion, showed up in some of these essays?
Yeah, so we did a special section. Hopefully to the people who haven't seen Vermont Almanac, the sort of diversity or maybe the hodgepodge-ness of the book is coming through in this discussion, because you'll find how to trim your lilacs, followed by a sort of special section on faith. Faith on the Vermont landscape is what we called it. Mm. And we've done a couple of these. A couple of years ago, we sort of dove into the issue of race on the Vermont landscape. And this year, we looked at faith. And as you mentioned, I think in the intro to the piece, the studies that we had looked at said that Vermont is the third least religious state. It seems to be all in New England in the top three. But we were interested in finding out from people who do have a religious faith what their connection to the land is. It's very, I think, probably common for people here to say, to associate their, instead of faith, maybe a spirituality mm-hmm. that they find in nature.
Yeah.
But that comes through, I think, in a lot of pieces that we've run over the years. And here we wanted to look specifically at people who are still following a religious faith in some traditional sense. And we have two of the contributors from a Christian perspective. One, Amy Bowen, who's running a Christian organization that sort of gets people out onto the land and appreciating the land and healing with the land. The gist of the story that she writes about is building a mobile chicken coop using wood taken from the land and sort of the lessons inherent in that. And the other Christian piece was a group, the Kudelowskis, Mark and Lisa, who have a small Benedictine-based group, homestead in Vermont, have people come to spend time with them there. And they really are, I think, in their piece, they focus on the importance of place. Staying home is really the heart of their homestead, is loving that particular land, the 70 acres that they are living on, and tying that to the sort of tenets of Benedict, St. Benedict. We also spoke with the Islamic Society of Vermont and found out about the Muslim faith in the state, the fastest growing faith actually in Vermont. The number of people that may not necessarily be familiar with a rural lifestyle when they come here, and the sort of aspects of it that they're starting to appreciate, and the halal meat that they're working with local farms to source, and people showing up at the prayers with apples or whatever they've got from their garden, sort of the as you'd expect any Vermonter of any faith or background to do. And finally, a group community we visited in Northfield, Living Tree Alliance, a Jewish-based organization. It's a group home and farm that they're running there, and to sort of find out about, we sort of looked at the traditional role that the land and agriculture played in the Jewish faith, and how they're carrying that tradition on there. So it was really neat to see, I think, completely different faiths in some ways appreciating the land in similar ways. And I think the kind of thing that probably nobody else is doing in Vermont, exploring that sort of thing. So I took a little special pride in doing that. And again, I hope that sort of showcases the diversity of the book. When you're looking, I'm just flipping the book now and looking at how to make flower jellies, or the secrets of Luna moth tails. There's a lot of different things covered in the book.
Yeah, and one of the things I really appreciate about the Vermont Almanac is the way that you all seem to try to balance, as you were just saying, Patrick, some of these newer traditions of rural life that are being incorporated into Vermont communities right now as our population changes, while also honoring some of those older traditions that are at risk of disappearing as life here changes, as the economy develops new directions. Dave, are there any particular rural Vermont traditions that you worry are not being passed down to new generations that you kind of hope the Vermont Almanac could help keep alive?
Yeah, I, you know, like everybody, I have worries, and like everyone, I kind of look at how things are changing, and it in some ways it makes me concerned. But there's also just a lot. Part of what we're trying to do with this book is capturing the stuff and getting it down to say, oh, look, this is important. This is who we are as a state, and the parts that are truly special are the rural part, and to get even more specific than that, I think it's working with the land. It's not land under glass as a you know, something that you drive by on the way to the mall or wherever. It's actually people devoting their life to these seasonal rhythms and to this place. And it could mean, you know, that the seventh generation dairy farmer who, you know, wakes up and every day is working the land, that falls under the umbrella. But also, you know, the person who works a day job and then comes home and feeds their three pigs that they're going to raise for meat for that winter, or cans their 30 quarts of tomatoes. You know, even though you can go to the store and buy tomato sauce for $2.50, they're still going to do that. And it's, you know, that's faith, you know, it's in not a capital R religious way, but these seasonal rhythms, the act of being present in the seasons, of putting your food up, of feeling the cold on your skin, of planting your garden, of you know, there's a lot of, as long as we keep that, then we're, you know, we're dragging these important things into the future with us, that's going to keep Vermont rural and keep it what it is.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, beyond specific skills, I think it's a culture. As Dave read a little earlier in the preamble section, I think that's what came through to me in those words is sort of the relationship with the place that we live in and the sort of a culture of a simple life. The specific skills can be passed on, and hopefully we're doing a little bit of that. But I think probably what I hope we're doing most is keeping that culture alive.
We have to keep defining, you know, who we are. Like we are, on an individual sense, we're the stories. You know, our life is the collection of stories that we, you know, you have a little kid, I think, Michaela, mm-hmm. and I have a 7-year-old too, and you're very conscious of that, especially with young people, where you're creating your identity based on the stories you tell yourself about your life. You know, mm-hmm. this is, as parents, you're like, this is who we are, and it never leaves you. And it's the same with places as it is with people. What kind of a state are we? What are the things that we value? And you need to constantly, you know, tell these stories and share these stories and have these conversations. And that's how you keep that. You keep this place a special place with a special connection to the land, and you don't turn into something else that's...
You two and your fellow editors at the Vermont Almanac really have weaved something together into book form that is made of many different art forms. We've talked essays, photographs, paintings, and there's poetry too. We actually have a recording of a poem by Veranda Porsche of Guilford, and it is called Winter Talk. You can find it in the February section. Let's take a listen.
Ed Petrie, bachelor mechanic, says, "Heaven is holding a wrench in my hand, but I wasn't much good at school. The wind chill is well below zero. We talk by his wood stove, jacket shawled around his shoulders. Put insulation in to warm the place up, and then the mice come and put the insulation where they like it. Last fall, it was chipmunks stuffed an exhaust pipe in the pickup out back. When I started it up, it blew a hole in the muffler. No, it won't be 80 in here till it's 50 outdoors. Ed turned 85 the day before I came. He smiles at our cake. How did you celebrate? I warmed the blankets, he laughs, pointing to the bedroom around the corner from what's now the kitchen where he was born. Hibernating. Yes, the winter torpor. I am happy to gather his language easy as laundry and read it back someday, soon. He will say, it is nothing killing the afternoon. And coming home, my kitchen smells like his, wood-smoked wool, and old."
That was Veranda Porsche reading her poem Winter Talk from the fifth volume of the Vermont Almanac. Yes, winter torpor. I love that line. For the two of you who both spend so much time in the outdoors, even in the winter, in this state, I'm wondering if you might be able to offer those of us who struggle with this time of year, particularly when we kind of start to enter into mud season in the middle of December and January. How do you keep your spirits up during this time of year?
I'm going to kind of merge your question, Michaela, with I'm still just letting Veranda's poem ring in my ears.
It's beautiful.
As she is a treasure. I guess to answer your question, it would be to notice. One of the things that I loved about that poem was Ed Petrie was smiling. He was being present, and he was feeling that wood stove on his skin, and he was laughing that it wouldn't be be 80 until it was 50 outside in his house. It makes me think of, I grew up in an old house with looking at the blooms of frost on the window, and I still live in an old house. I live in an older house now, and it's still watching that bloom on the inside of the window, feeling the cold, to feel it. That's the way I enjoy every season, just by it all has its gifts, and if just being there with it, and if it's a muddy March, that has its versions of it too. It's not the stinging cold of the frost and December, January, hopefully. But it's, stick season has its charms too. Look at the way the moss is green this March. Or actually, you can go outside right in late December and watch how those greens pop. And look at the lichen on the trees, the patterns, which are stunning in March and during stick season. That's, finding those pleasures. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. Patrick, what pleasures do you find at this time of year?
Well, I wish I could say I was as active in the winter as I am in the summer. I like to bike, and that season gets cut relatively short this time of year. But yeah. I think the one thing, my wife and I would take a lot of walks or snowshoes around our Christmas tree farm, around the field. And it's nice to actually be up there at the one time of year where we're not doing any work. We're just out for a walk. We can sort of ignore the trees if we choose to, knowing that we don't need to do any work on them at that point, or we can sort of appreciate all the work that went into getting them to that point. And the other thing I think that sticks out to me of winter, I have an outdoor wood boiler. So every night I go out and sort of to stock it up for the night, and sort of looking at the sky it's neat to chart winter that way. I mean, some of the clear nights are incredibly stunning, with almost no light. It's still among the most stunning things you can see in the state. Hmm.
Listening to our answers, maybe we've missed the point of the poem, and torpor and hibernation is really what
to rest, right?
Maybe.
Right.
Maybe that was Ed Petrie's lesson.
Yeah, it's dark at 4:20. Just go to bed.
Curling up with a copy of Vermont Almanac.
Way to bring it back.
There you go.
We do have to wrap up, but before we do, I want to read a couple emails that we got during this segment. Marnie in Middlebury writes in praise of the wonderful painting by Hannah Sessions of Blue Ledge Farm.
You're here.
So stunning as you progress through the chapter portions, Marnie writes. And John in Bridport writes, I am a retired logger who worked with Dave's dad, Dave T. Mance Jr., in the woods for many years. I'm also a relative newcomer to Vermont, coming here with the long-haired rush in the 70s. For those of us who appreciate, know, love the old way of Vermont life and its close connection to the land, the Vermont Almanac to me is a bridge to that way of life. Well done. Do you know this John we speak of, Dave?
Yeah.
and these paintings by Hannah Sessions. Patrick, can you give us a little glimpse into them?
Yeah, each volume of the Almanac is a cover painting by a Vermont artist. And then each chapter begins with a painting. So 12 chapter art, we call them, by a different artist. And Hannah Sessions has a, I think it's a sheep and goat farm. And some of her paintings feature the sheep and goats or other farm animals. And I agree with the listener who wrote in. They're beautiful. I love there's a lot of texture to the art, and it's just another nice piece, a piece of the puzzle to sort of add to all the words that are in there to have that beautiful Vermont art. And I should say that the book's even printed in Vermont. It is a Vermont project from start to finish. It's printed by Volante up in Milton. It's designed by Lisa Cadu, who's up in the islands now. It's start to finish a Vermont project, and definitely something we take pride in.
Yeah. You just got to get that paper made from Vermont trees and exactly. then you got the whole
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Sure. Maybe the sixth volume when it comes out next yeah. year. Dave Mance of Shaftesbury and Patrick White of Middlesex, thank you both so much for coming in and telling us about the Almanac.
That's been
thank
a pleasure.
Thank you, Michaela.
Thank you for having us.
The Vermont Almanac, which we were just talking about, is one of the newer almanacs to be out there and published. It's just 5 years old. The Old Farmer's Almanac is, as per its name, the oldest. It was first issued in 1792, and it has been continuously published ever since. Joining us from Keene, New Hampshire, is Carol Conair. She's the 14th editor-in-chief of the Old Farmer's Almanac and just the second woman at the top of the masthead. Carol, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Michaela.
Yeah, we are so glad to have you and to talk about this almanac. It's one that I've known about, I feel like, my whole life, but I've never really stopped to think about the fact that it has been in continuous publication since the 18th century. That is remarkable.
It's pretty amazing. It's very cool to have those old issues also, you know, right here in our offices for inspiration
yeah.
if we ever need to go back.
Yes. And on the cover, there are two faces on there. I'm looking at them right now. Benjamin Franklin and Robert B. Thomas. Who are those two folks? I mean, we know who Ben Franklin is, but why is he one of the two people on the front of this almanac?
Well, Ben Franklin is really considered the father of the American almanac. And Robert B. Thomas is the founder of the Old Farmer's Almanac. And it was wonderful to hear your conversation with the editors of the Vermont Almanac, because almanacs really have a history of many. It's really rare. You know, we have survived for a long time, but many almanacs were around when we started out. Certainly Poor Richard's, you know, Benjamin Franklin's almanac was out long before us. But that idea, the idea of a calendar, the idea of weather and seasonality and things that people need to know, that really was Ben's idea from the beginning.
Mm. And as you mentioned, the original editor was Robert Bailey Thomas. He founded the Almanac and ran it for more than 50 years until he died in 1846. How do you think back on his legacy today?
Oh, he's really our inspiration. I think he had the wonderful recipe that we still work with today for the, you know, the ingredients of why our almanac is popular. You know, this idea that it needs to be informative and useful and never, ever, you know, falter on that front, but also to be entertaining. You know, when Robert B. Thomas started our almanac, every other person was a farmer. And, you know, this, and maybe in the house you had a Bible and an almanac, not a lot of, maybe there was a broadside, you know, if you were lucky, but this idea that, you know, something for every day of the year, something useful. And then I think over time, what we see with Robert B. Thomas is that he listened to his readers. And that's what we do as well. You know, it's over those 50 years of his editorship, certainly growing, changed, and so did information about the world around us. And he always brought in the new. And so I think that is another idea of this almanac. It's like, yes, we want to have some of those traditions and a lot of that old, useful know-how, but at the same time, new knowledge is also available for us. So what is it? And then he was an astronomer. And so, you know, the backbone of our almanac is our weather predictions and also, you know, sky watching. This is something that it was a passion of his, and he was really up on everything new in astronomy.
Hmm. Okay, so you mentioned that there is this backbone of the almanac that sticks with it today, but there's also, of course, so much new science that informs how you make this product now. I'm so curious to hear more, Carol, about how the weather predictions used to be made back in the 18th and 19th centuries. I heard there's some sort of like secret forecasting formula that's like physical that you keep in a box somewhere. Is that true?
Well, I think that was more myth and folklore than truth. It is true that we for a long time kept some of the original calculations, but we do have an archive at the University of Massachusetts Amherst of Yankee Publishing, and it has some of those original papers now, so they're in good keeping. But it is fun to look back in those calculations. And honestly, it's not, it is a proprietary formula, and it's, we still use the same ideas today. And that is that for long, you know, it's crazy, right? To long-term weather forecast. But the idea being that we have a lot of information about, we have a lot of data. Yeah. And for Robert B. Thomas, again, his idea was that we can look at the sun, the cycles of the magnetic storms on the sun, also known as the sun cycles. They occur in these 11-year, pretty standard patterns, and you were at the apex of cycle 25 now. And so those, that's a lot of information, you know, 25 cycles of 11 years. And it, essentially what we do is look for patterns over time, repetitive patterns, you know, year seven of, you know, that has some of these other indicators with it. What happened then? What will happen now? Of course, we also consult climate science and meteorology, but the basis of our prognosticating, if you will, is really about this idea of data and crunching it, you know, lots of it over time. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite sections of the Old Farmer's Almanac to look through is in the astrology section. I'm usually not an astrology fan, but I just loved looking at this. There's something called the Best Days for 2025, and it's a chart that the almanac says is based on the moon sign and shows the best days each month for certain activities. And some of those activities include the best day to quit smoking each month, the best day to color your hair, the best day to wash your windows, and the best day to purchase animals or slaughter livestock. It's so fun to look at. What's the purpose of something like this? Is it just for fun, or are you thinking, you know, maybe people are really going to pick these days to make some big life choices or changes?
Well, I mean, it seems a little tongue-in-cheek, except the truth is that this is, people depend on this, depend on the almanac for this. They really consult this. And, you know, why is that? Are we, you know, as we know, astronomy and astrology are really different, and one is science and others would say is a science as well. But I think this is the idea of the almanac generally, is that, okay, is it crazy to forecast the weather? But again, any leg up, you know, a grower in those times when we started out, and even today, you know, what is it that I can use? What kind of information can I use to do it a little better or hedge my bets? And I think that's what Best Days is all about. You know, there, we have a story in the 2025 edition about how to garden in sync with the moon, which is an astronomical story. You know, we know that the moon has these 28-day cycles, and what is that doing? And so for years, you know, since the almanac began, farmers and growers have been looking at those moon cycles. You know, we know that the moon controls the tides and pulls water gravitationally. And so that really has a lot of actual implications in the earth when we're growing things. And so part of that Best Days, the idea of when to prune, when to mow for lower growth or greater growth, and all those ideas have to do with also the astronomy of the moon cycles, as well as kind of laying the astrology on top of that. So yeah, very popular. And I will say that we have a fun story in the works for 2026. My colleague, editor Tim Goodwin, has been trying many of those things on that chart according to the best days and a few of the not best days. So he'll report on that next year.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, thanks to your advice, I'm going to perm my hair on January 1st or 2nd of this year. So my husband will thank you, or not. One tradition that has stuck with the magazine for decades is this little hole that's in the top left of the almanac. Excuse me, not magazine, almanac. What's the hole for? It goes all the way through it.
Yes. Yeah. And well, and we've tried to take it out because it's not inexpensive to have that hole. So, you know, many people might say you put a string through it and it went in your outhouse. But really, like my nephew has a little horse farm in Kentucky. He's got a nail for it right in his barn. So again, it's just this idea of it's something you need versus something you might want. And if you need it, where is it going to be the most handy? And so it's not, you know, something that you read once and then it, you know, goes into the recycling bin. It is something that you can use every day of the year. In fact, when we look at, you know, the data of our readers, they're coming back to it. Often people will purchase an almanac toward the end of the year, and then the best time for them to pick it back up is February and March. Not a surprise when we're all ready to get that ground turned over and get growing, you know.
Well, you mentioned your work has already begun on the 2026 Old Farmer's Almanac. How far in advance do you and your staff work?
Well, on some stories, we can work very far in advance, you know, feature stories that we know we want to have in. You know, we can do a few of those things that are timeless or real, you know, chestnuts. We can get those in the works certainly a year ahead. But the weather, as we were mentioning, really comes in last of all. And also our trends section in the front, our trends writers and researcher is really incredible. But again, we want that latest information. So sort of this mix that we always do of the old and the new, we're going to tackle, you know, those chestnuts first, and then we're going to get that copy in later, like our farmers' calendars, for instance, or even the doggerel, which is the poetry that runs through our calendars. You know, that's something that comes in really late in the game, even in the spring. And since we print so many copies, you know, it's over 2 million in several formats.
Wow.
We really need to get that on the printer in the summer. So we're printing, you know, in June to get that into stores for August.
Mm. Carol Conair is the editor-in-chief of the Old Farmer's Almanac, which was first issued in 1792. She joined us today from Keene, New Hampshire. Carol, thank you so much for calling in. It was so fascinating to learn about the almanac.
Thank you, Michaela. It was a great show.